This week on Box Talks, why have some European cities been left behind? And what can we do to reduce regional inequality? Welcome to Vox Talks from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. My name is Tim Phillips. And welcome to the second of our Vox Talks from the Dutch Central Bank in Amsterdam at the SWEF DNB conference. Now, SWEF was founded in 1963 by a group of academics and bankers, and they focused on financial markets, institutions and regulation. But many of the presentations and debates at the conference in 2020 might have seemed odd choices only a decade ago. But now they're very important to the agendas of central banks, financial institutions and politicians. One of those debates at the conference this year is about regional inequality. At Vox Talks, we're very interested in this because later this year, the CEPR will be launching a research and policy network on exactly this topic, and more of that later. Speaking at the conference this year is the economist who will be running our network, and that's Tony Venables of the University of Oxford. And he's just been described at the conference, much to his embarrassment, as the godfather of agglomeration economics. He spoke about his recent work, and that argues that the differences between agglomerations are likely to increase the problems of regional inequality rather than reduce or eliminate them. The problem, he argues, is that cities that lose economic activity in tradable sectors that have economies of scale tend to replace it with untradables, which don't.
I mean, we know that agglomeration causes activity to cluster, causes cities to form. Not all agglomerations are alike, and you have to go back to the sectoral productive forces that are or are not driving the agglomeration. And we know that in sectors like finance, high tech, creative, these are really powerful forces. In lots of other activities, you know, backroom, government services, food, retailing, they're not so strong.
Why is it that they're not so strong? What is it about them?
If your product is essentially non-tradable, you've got to be close to the market. You've got to be close to the consumer. So concentrating it all in one place doesn't make sense. You know, international financial services or Hollywood, yes. Food retailing, no.
So you don't have these increasing returns to scale that people assume that you have with agglomeration.
That's right. So you just need to think about it sector by sector a little bit and then map that into city by city.
So as a diagnosis, we have this, and we have some cities that are doing well because of the sorts of sectors that are in them, other cities that are not doing well. The problem that you've got is you can't just move bits of the good cities to the other cities, can you? No one wants to go.
Yeah, that's right. So as soon as you're in an agglomeration world, we have this first mover problem. You don't want to leave the agglomeration. You're a firm getting all these productivity benefits. You don't want to move out of the agglomeration and go somewhere else. It's just hard to start new activities in those sectors, in new places, in different places.
What can we do about that?
Well, we can try and make it easier. The way I frame this is to think about towns that have lost a traditional tradable sector. You know, they've lost their shipbuilding or their engineering or their textiles. And what do they then do? And my answer to that, in the UK at least, is they tend to just switch to doing rather low-quality, non-tradable jobs. They probably maintain full employment, but with lower productivity, lower house prices, lower skill requirements, and become rather unsatisfactory places. That's not answering your question, what can we do?
No.
Well, there is no magic bullet. If there were, we wouldn't be sitting here talking
about
this.
Yeah.
You have to make these secondary cities less unattractive places to start up new high-value activities.
And that means infrastructure.
And I think the starting point for that is actually in governance of the cities.
Mm-hmm.
Who is it who is both empowered, incentivized, and responsible for the economic prosperity of the city? Who is it who's responsible for actually making the city a less unattractive place for inwards investment? And at the moment, no one is responsible. The power is very diffuse.
And it's one of these things that in different countries is done very, very differently. Has anyone really cracked this model well?
Devolution to powerful city mayors, I think, is part of the story. We're experimenting with that in the UK. Obviously, a lot of American cities have turned themselves around. yeah. because someone has the power to do it. And in a rather different context, I mean, Chinese cities have done remarkably well yeah. in actually growing and investing and attracting jobs because there are people incentivized and empowered to make the city work. Yeah. Not saying China's the perfect model.
For many parts of the UK, you're not a big fan of what's happened in regional development there. In many cases, I think you're saying it's making it worse.
If regional policy has the effect of just moving these non-agglomeration, non-tradable, rather low-value activities into a place, then that's valuable insofar as maybe solving an unemployment problem. That you're just filling these cities up with rather low-value stuff rather than focusing on making them higher value, high productivity, you know, more internationally competitive cities. You know, we want our cities to be able to produce goods and services that are internationally competitive, and rather few of them can.
On the panel at this conference with Tony was Charles Goodhart of the LSE. Now 83 years old, Charles was advising the British government's Department of Economic Affairs back in the mid-60s, when some of the left-behind cities of today's Europe were centres of economic activity.
I agreed with everything that Tony Venables said. I think it is very difficult to just transplant tradable goods industries from the areas where there are roots, agglomeration advantages. You know, I mean, take something like the City of London, which has got a large agglomeration. It is an area where you have trained lawyers and trained accountants. There are more lawyers with understanding of financial contracts in London than there is the whole of the rest of continental Europe.
Charles's argument is that changes in demography, globalization, and technology that we have recently seen have increased regional inequality, but now they're slowing down or reversing. Nevertheless, the problems they have caused have been decades in the making and are going to take decades to solve as well.
Demography is changing because of the declining birth rate and the increasing life expectancy. And recently, the large proportion of the labour force in the advanced economies, which have not done so well, have voted for parties which are trying to cut back on globalisation in general, and immigration in particular.
Because one thing that we can say is even if these forces abate, it doesn't necessarily mean that we're in an equilibrium, that's some kind of ideal state of inequality at all, are we?
No, indeed not. But it's not going to get worse. And the shift in demography and the reduction in globalization are probably such that the bargaining power of the labor force in major advanced economies is going to strengthen from a very weak starting point, but it is going to strengthen. And at some point, it's going to mean that the divergence between the incomes of those with a lot of human capital, managers and so on, and the ordinary worker is going to start getting back again. It's going to come back again. Inequality within countries, I think, will start falling within the next decade or so and continue to fall for decades after that.
One thing that Tony Venables pointed out was the failures of regional policy at fixing some of these problems. What policy interventions do you think can work?
I think that there is a serious problem. And if I was sort of asked to consider policies, I would note that the new industries are very largely science-related, and the science relationship is related to universities. So one of the things that I would do is, if I wanted to do territorial regeneration, is to shift funding and try and shift governmental support to the universities in the areas, and in particular in the metropolitan centres of the regions which are doing less well. So if you strengthen the universities, they may enable you to get tradable goods, new industries, scientific-based industries developing around those universities, related to the university structures.
This takes a long time, doesn't it? It requires a long-term focus.
Absolutely, but it's been a very long time. The UK really got into trouble in World War I.
It's a long run, yes.
Because all our basic tradable goods industries, textiles, shipbuildings, and so on. And we lost a huge proportion of our markets in World War One, and we never really got back again.
And you also argue that the impact of these changes that have been going on for the last 30 years, this has contributed to the political changes that we've also seen, the rise of populism,
yes,
and ultimately to contributed to Brexit as well.
Indeed, absolutely right. But again, the question that I raise is, given that it is the workers, the blue-collar workers, who have been worst off as a result, why did that not benefit the parties of the left? To which my answer is, in the one word, is immigration.
Mm-hmm.
That because of their idealism, brotherhood of man and whatever, and also because those parties of the left have almost always become the parties to which the immigrants naturally then support in their voting. So the parties of the left, they have great problems in dealing with the question of migration. Although the economists who specialize in this area argue that immigration and migration inwards has not actually seriously or even at all adversely affected the workers, the people involved just don't believe it. There's this huge distinction between what people believe about the effects of immigration on their societies and themselves and their conditions, and what the, if you like, the expert economists say. Immigration is the area above all where Michael Gove's point about we've had too much of experts really does resonate with the general public. When the economists say migration is good for the people involved in the areas of those left behind, the ordinary person just doesn't believe a word of it.
And this isn't just a UK phenomenon, is it? This has been going on all over the developed world.
It's Trump, Salvini in Italy, the Front National in France. It's more or less everywhere. It's Hungary, it's Greece. There's hardly a country in Europe where this issue doesn't arise.
So ultimately, even if the factors that have been pushing inequality, even if those ease up a little bit, we might have a long-term political legacy. That's kind of left behind, and that leaves a long-term imprint.
Yes, indeed it does. Of course it does. One of the adverse features of what's happened in America is that Trump came into office in much the same way that Boris Johnson has now come into office, promising to make America great again, which effectively meant to provide the blue-collar workers who had difficulties with new jobs and making their condition better. As far as I can tell, Trump's not actually delivered on that. Now, Boris Johnson has come into office effectively promising exactly the same kind of thing. And what we will have to see is whether the populist parties of the right, who come to power largely to counter migration and restore the position of the working classes in that area, whether Boris Johnson does, you will see.
We will have to wait and see. But are you an optimist about whether we can fix these left behind areas, whether we can revitalize them?
I think it would be a slow exercise.
Regional inequality raises questions of migration, populism, politics, the risks of bad policy, many other questions as well. So back to Tony. What is the CEPR's research and policy network going to be writing about?
I am assembling a team of people. We will meet, hopefully produce some early policy papers, possibly an ebook, and hopefully feed into government decision taking, which is an area that is prioritized, but not clear the government have the answers.
If any of our audience on Vox Talks wants to get involved with this, is it best for them to get in touch with you?
I would be happy to receive emails and contacts from people who were interested in being involved.
All offers of help gratefully received, Tony.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
And thanks also to Charles Goodhart and the SWEV conference. Next week, regional inequality again. Does the way we measure it change our policy towards it? This has been a Vox Talk from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. There are new episodes every week, and remember you can catch up with 10 years of Vox Talks at voxeu.org/vox-talks.